You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
What we're dealing with here is a total lack of respect for the law.
You're listening to Done by Law, brought to you by the Federation of Community Legal Centres.
Welcome, dear listeners, and welcome to this night's episode of Done by Law on 3CR 855 AM. And also welcome to those listening via various podcast platforms or via streaming on 3cr.org.au. You're with Jimmy tonight, just me, sorry, but don't worry, we've got a guest dialing in shortly, so you won't get too sick of my voice. As always, we would like to start tonight's show by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation as the original and rightful custodians of the land that 3CR broadcasts from. I also wanted to acknowledge that tonight we're speaking on issues that affect all mob across Australia and about disruption to connection to country. Our deepest respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge these lands were stolen, never ceded, always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Tonight's guest is Environmental Justice Australia, EJA for short. EJA's climate team represents, advocates, and acts for community groups and others impacted by the climate crisis. They focus on legal action that assists in the fight to reduce climate change, facilitate a just energy transition to reduce pollution, and secure climate justice, advocating and litigating for climate action. Hannah White is a senior lawyer in EJA's climate team. Hannah works in their team as a senior lawyer and joins us on the show. Before joining EJA, she had a glittering career working as a senior prosecutor with the federal government, running criminal matters including environmental and white-collar crime prosecutions. She has also worked with the Net Zero Lawyers Alliance to help legal practitioners provide net zero aligned advice. Hannah and her team are now representing 10 Australians in their human rights case against the Australian government for failing to protect our communities from climate pollution caused by Australia's coal and gas corporations. It's also known as the Hard Truths case. We'll be getting stuck into some of those hard truths tonight. Hannah joins us on the line tonight to discuss this exciting action and change and the change that EJA, hopes to see come from it. Welcome to the show, Hannah.
Thanks so much for having me, Jimmy.
So before we get into the nitty-gritty of tonight's topic, can you tell us about what action is being taken and what is actually required to file a case against the Australian government before the United Nations Human Rights Commission? It sounds too exciting and too good to be true. Tell us more.
Absolutely, and I'm really excited to talk about it. So in June, 10 Australians filed a human rights case against the Australian government with the UN Human Rights Committee for failing to protect them from climate pollution caused by Australia's coal and gas corporations. And they argue that the Australian government is breaching its obligations under international human rights law by continuing to approve and subsidise coal and gas for export without a plan to protect people from foreseeable climate harm. And they say that Australia's conduct violates their right to life, their right to have a family, privacy and home, and their right to culture.
Yeah, right. And so tell us a little bit more about these 10 Australians. Like you touched on a couple of things there, but they really are from all walks of life and all corners of the country. How did they come to litigate their human rights in this way and what connects them all?
Yeah, sure. So these 10 Australians, as you mentioned, come from all across the country. They're all different ages. They've had different upbringings. But I think the common thread that really connects them all is the way that climate change has already started to upend their lives, their homes, and for the First Nations people in the group, their culture. To share some of their stories, there's Professor Anne Polina, who is a First Nations woman from the Kimberley in Western Australia. Anne belongs to the Mardawarra, the Fitzroy River, which she calls the River of Life. And after witnessing the devastating floods in 2023, which displaced her from her home for years, she decided to make a complaint to the UN about the impacts this has had on her country and her ability to practice and transmit culture to future generations. On the other side of the country, there's Brendan, who during the 2022 Brisbane floods was trapped alone in his apartment for 10 days after floodwaters prevented him from safely getting out of his building. Brendan's legally blind and he's an incredible disability and climate advocate, and he describes being absolutely terrified at how unprepared our systems are to protect people with disabilities during climate disasters. And then there's Jack, who lost his home and almost his life during the Black Summer bushfires, that I'm sure we all remember tore through huge parts of Australia at the end of 2019. So those are just some of the claimants' stories about how climate change has already deeply affected their lives, and that very much comes through all of the 10 Australians who have made this complaint.
Yeah, fascinating. And, some really big moments in recent Australian history, and just those anecdotes reminds us how severe the impact of the increasing frequency of natural disasters has on our communities. You know, we speak about statistics of number of houses flooded or this or that or the other, and we often kind of forget the individual story. And not that once it leaves the news cycle the issue is over, but the long lasting impact of these disasters as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think, you know, in bringing this case, we've had so many people share stories about how they identify with the experiences that these 10 Australians have had. You know, it's I feel like there is a lot of common threads, not only in what our clients have experienced, but also in the way people across Australia are experiencing the really serious impacts of climate change.
Yeah, fascinating. And, look, I think one of the small problems of living under a Labor government is that the uninformed Australian can often think that we're doing okay in these times in these types of things, in terms of our pollution production and transition to renewables. What are some of the hard truths in this case that the Hard Truths case aims to bring to light?
So this case is specifically focused on Australia's exports of fossil fuels across the globe. And what the evidence in this case shows is that the Australian government, or Australia generally, is one of the world's largest exporters of coal and gas. I think we sit around second in the world. So that's pretty huge. Mm. And around 80% of Australia's coal and gas that's produced here is shipped overseas to be burnt. And because it's for export, it's excluded from all of Australia's climate targets and its policies. But, you know, what we know from the experiences that I've just shared from some of the claimants in this case is that the harm from that coal and gas doesn't stay overseas. It comes back to us as fires, floods, extreme heats, drought, algal blooms. And that's really the hard truth that this case asks the Australian government to confront. You know, that climate harm caused by Australia's coal and gas doesn't stop at a border, and neither does Australia's responsibility or accountability for it, especially to people and communities who are feeling it the most.
Yeah, interesting. And that's one of the things that, when I was researching for tonight's chat with you, was something that I was totally unaware of, was this kind of sweeping under the rug, or I guess sweeping off out of our borders, this statistics in regards to our pollution data. Can you expand on that a little bit more, if that's okay, and just explain like how that mechanism works and how it therefore doesn't just vanishes from our government's consciousness or our collective consciousness?
Yeah, sure. So I guess to give a little bit more detail, so Australia's climate targets and policies only focus on or look at our domestic emissions, so things burnt here. Mm. So as an example, Australia's emission reduction laws, which are known as kind of like the safeguard mechanism, I think a lot of people know it as that, mm-hmm. only count emissions that are burnt here and not overseas. Mm. And there's a number of reasons why the Australian government considers that it shouldn't count its exported emissions, and I won't go into those details because it's kind of a convoluted process where we reference international treaties and a number of things that have come out of diplomatic negotiations. But I think, you know, at the heart of this issue is the Australian government has really determined that it isn't responsible or accountable for its exported emissions, and that is very much reflected in its domestic laws here. So in the safeguard mechanism, in its climate change law, and in other environmental protection laws, which don't count any of Australia's exported emissions at all.
Yeah, so I guess the simplified version is that, like, we've generated all this kind of, I don't know if this is the right term, like bureaucratic infrastructure around ensuring that we're not overpolluting and we're not, I guess, contributing to the climate crisis more per capita than we should be. But some of the critical aspects, some of the critical data and some of the, I guess, most significant pollution gets shipped offshore. We then reap the benefits of it onshore both before and after, and yet none of that is counted in our total output.
None of it is. And, you know, I guess like this also feeds into when you were talking about reaping the benefits, and I suppose this isn't relevant to the hard truth case in a lot of ways, but it is, but it isn't, is the gas tax that's currently being spoken about. Mm. You know, we don't even get the royalties from the fossil fuel exports we ship overseas. Well, the Australian government does. So, it's a really huge gap in what's happening here in terms of climate pollution, and we're seeing that gap come back to communities and people.
Yeah, let's not get too far into mining royalties and gas tax tonight, because that's a whole nother episode which I would love to have your team on to chat about. But let's stick to some of these hard truths. And just because I want to keep the impact of these individuals, both the impact they're having for Australians and the impact these hard truths are having on them, can we come back to some examples and like what ways these hard truths impact everyday Australians, whether it's the 10 individuals that are fundamental to this case or Australians more broadly?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head, Junior. Like at the heart of this case, it comes back to people and the people and how people and communities are threatened by climate change and have already been impacted. Mm. It's about communities being displaced from country. It's about people fearing they won't survive another heat wave. And it's about firefighters, you know, or first responders watching disasters become more severe and more frequent and it being out of their control to really do anything. And I think this case is also about responsibility and particularly the hard truth, you know, as we were just talking about, that the Australian government is responsible for protecting people from this foreseeable climate harm and protecting communities and home and culture and country. And I think what the stories of these 10 Australians show is that climate change and the harms it brings is not just a distant future threat. It's happening now, and the Australian government has a responsibility to face the hard truth of that and stop making a dangerous problem worse.
Yeah, it's kind of horrifying to think about when I was a little hippie child watching and trying to get all my family members to watch An Inconvenient Truth, and how at that point it was kind of an inconvenience in some ways. It was panic stations because this was on our doorstep, and to wake up 20 odd years later and it is on our doorstep, it's in our houses, it's in our rivers, it's on our properties at such a horrifying frequency compared to what we're traditionally used to. It's good to see that someone at least is acknowledging the transition from an inconvenient truth to some hard truths that we everyday Australians are experiencing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Bringing it back to these 10 Australians, so why does EJA see this as the pathway forward to advocate for these 10 Australians? And what is the hopeful outcome for this case?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, what's striking about all of the people involved in this case is just how much climate change has completely pervaded and impacted their lives. Mm. And I think cases like these elevate and put a spotlight on just how important it is to listen to people at the front lines of climate change. Mm. When it comes to addressing, you know, or advocating for the mitigation or adaptation remedies that we're seeking. In terms of the hopeful outcome for this case, I think an important thing to note is that the decisions of the UN Human Rights Committee, where this case has been filed, is not binding. But even though it's not binding, the decisions from the committee do carry pretty significant political, moral, diplomatic weight, especially on the global stage. And I think an important thing to add to that is that Australia has already agreed to the human rights obligations, which are a key issue in this case. So I think, you know, the hopeful outcome, if this case is successful, is that the Australian government complies with its obligations under international law. And, you know, we expect them, in response to a successful committee decision, to see them take immediate action to reduce climate pollution that comes from Australia's coal and gas, particularly the coal and gas that, as we've discussed, is shipped overseas. Mm. And practically, what that would look like is not approving future coal and gas projects, including those projects marked for export overseas, and making a tangible plan to protect people, like the 10 Australians in this complaint, from future climate harm.
Yeah, right. So I guess, at the very least, if the action's successful, a clear fail mark for the Australian government in what they're supposed to be doing and doing what they've agreed to do.
Yes, absolutely.
So, like I said, we've already kind of touched on some of the individuals involved in this action, but I'm interested in kind of some of, I guess, the ways that people might not immediately think that natural disasters and the climate crisis impacts people. Everyone's aware of houses burning down, houses flooding, cyclones tearing up houses, but I think what your case makes really clear is that there's a plethora of rights and ways to live that are being adversely impacted by the climate crisis. So starting with, I know we were talking about Professor Anne, I believe, up in the Kimberley, was it? How do these hard truths impact First Nations rights for Australians, for Indigenous Australians?
Look, the impact that climate change has on First Nations people's rights and their connection to country has been absolutely devastating, which has really, you know, rung true and become quite apparent through stories like Professor Anne's. Mm. And you know, for people like Ricky, who's another claimant, who is a Gudandji and Wakaya traditional owner from the Barkly Tablelands in the Northern Territory, climate change is making her country increasingly difficult and dangerous to live on. And it's disrupted her ability to engage in cultural practices and receive and pass on cultural knowledge. Tam and Letitia, who are two young sisters from Adelaide, who are Narunga, Narangeri and Kaurna women, are experiencing this as well when it comes to the impacts of the toxic algal bloom that hit Adelaide last year and is ongoing, have had on their sea country and their ability to you know, go and swim in the ocean and practice their culture and pass down cultural knowledge as well and receive it as young people. So it's been absolutely devastating and I think, you know, Anne, Ricky, Pam and Letitia are all such incredible advocates when it comes to speaking about their country. And we hope that the committee listens to the stories that they're telling about how climate change is impacting their rights to culture.
Yeah, it's quite a point of dismay when you hear about, you know, all of these different countries you've talked about today have had residents, First Nations people, traditional custodians on them for tens of thousands of years, if not more. And within a couple of hundred years of colonial Australia taking form, we're seeing the impacts of colonisation and industrialisation actually making these places that have been lived on time immemorium and cared for time immemorium becoming unlivable. It's quite horrifying to think about in that kind of big picture sense, and it's awesome to hear that these advocates are willing to I guess be the face of that in a way and kind of take their story forward as a key example.
Yeah, absolutely. They're honestly just such inspiring advocates, and we're just so lucky and proud to represent them, and I hope that the committee, you know, recognises that as well and makes the decision that we're hoping that they're going to make.
Yeah, fingers crossed. And what about other vulnerabilities that people might not think of initially when thinking of those impacted by the climate crisis?
Yeah, so I mentioned Brendan, who's legally blind and was trapped in the floodwaters, but I think people who live with chronic illnesses and disabilities are also very significantly impacted. in the context of climate change. Both Mel and Kat, who are claimants, both live in South Australia. And earlier this year, a heat wave, I think we can all remember the heat wave at the end of January ripped across most of Australia, and we were all living through consecutive 40-degree days.
Yeah.
And for Kat, that put her into total survival mode. And for Mel, who lives in public housing and has no air conditioner and a tin roof, she shares feeling like she was going to die overnight as the heat radiated from the walls, and she felt too sick to be able to stand up. So, you know, chronic illness and disabilities, again, are exacerbated by climate change. Something else that I also wanted to add is there's also a number of young people involved in this hard truth complaint. Salma, who is 21 years old and from Brisbane, now lives with extreme anxiety after the Brisbane floods inundated her home, and she had to set an alarm clock every 30 minutes to check water levels because she was so afraid that her and her family might be trapped and drown. And I've mentioned Pam and Letitia, who are young First Nations women who have seen their sea country decimated by the toxic algal bloom in South Australia. And I think what I find most striking, in particular for the stories that, Salma, Pam and Letitia share, and from what we know about climate science, is that for young people, this is not the end of their experience of living through climate extremes, natural disasters and the harm that's caused by it. And the expert evidence that we obtained as part of this case actually shows that people born in 2000 and beyond are 2.5 times more likely to experience extreme heat waves in their lifetime in comparison to somebody born in the 1960s.
More.
And that's just heat. That doesn't count flooding, algal blooms, droughts and storms that we know will intensify with climate change too. So I think young people, we all know, they're the future, and this is what they're facing down, and I think that really needs to be recognised as well.
Yeah, that is some horrifying statistics, even just on heat alone, and to think about the fires and the cyclones and the floods that have become so and so more common in our news cycle. It's horrifying to think about how much more frequently we are impacted by. I keep referring to them as natural disasters, but there is an element of human contribution here. What is EJA's view on the way to minimise the impact of worsening disasters in the context of climate policy? We talked about before kind of preventing new coal and gas projects. Is it as simple as that, or is there also kind of, I guess, an acceptance by the government to accept these hard truths as truths?
Yeah. Well, look, as a lawyer at EJA and as a public interest law firm, we represent our clients' views and clients who have been deeply impacted by the climate crisis. So our views on the legal avenues available to minimise the impacts they experience as a result of climate change is very much driven by their needs and their views. And I suppose to give the hard truth case as an example, the way this case seeks to minimise the impact of the climate crisis is to target the lack of climate policies and laws that exist when it comes to Australia's exported emissions. So as we were chatting about earlier this evening, around 80% of Australia's coal and gas is shipped overseas to be burned. But because it's for export, it's excluded from climate policies and targets like the safeguard mechanism. And because those exported emissions aren't counted, the Australian government hasn't to date been held to account under its domestic laws for the harm that those emissions cause. So by working with people like the hard truth claimants and communities that have been impacted by the climate crisis, we hope to spotlight their stories and pursue legal avenues that really kind of shine a light on the hard truth the government is, we say, sweeping under the carpet in a sense,
yeah.
And have them confront those and be held account for their contribution to the climate crisis, as well as coal and gas companies as well.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, sorry. My question was really asking you to do the government's job for it, whereas your client's lawyers, and as you should be, advocating for their rights and their outcomes, which is fantastic. Has EJA done this before? Are there any other examples of EJA successfully taking human rights complaints, successfully or unsuccessfully, I should say, taking human rights complaints to the UNHRC?
Not to the UN Human Rights Committee, but to other international legal experts and bodies. To give an example, last year, EJA represented a group of 9 incredible young Australians to make a complaint to the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Climate Change.
Mm.
And that special rapporteur is an independent human rights expert appointed by the UN to investigate the impacts of climate change on human rights, on the human rights of people and communities. So similar to the hard truth claimants, the nine young Australians have also experienced the worst of climate change, and they wrote to the special rapporteur with a complaint asking her to meet with them, shedding light on, again, the gaps in Australia's climate policies and targets that were harming them, and also to share their stories of climate harm. And they also asked her to write to the Australian government, flagging that the government's ongoing approval of coal and gas projects, like the big Northwest Shelf project, which was approved out to 2070 last year, was violating their human rights and harming their futures.
Yeah, wow. Well, I hope for all the success for these 10 Australians on behalf of many, many Australians impacted by the worsening climate crisis. Time has gotten away from me. I'm so sorry, but we probably have to wrap up. We'll make sure that we plug any links and make sure that it's easy for people to find out how to get to know these 10 Australians and their stories in the bio of the podcast and the episode. But was there anything else you wanted to add before we wrap up today?
No, thanks so much for having us, Jimmy. And, you know, if anybody wants to follow the Hard Truths claimants on Instagram, I think their handle is at Hard Truth Case.
Fantastic. I'll be hitting the follow button right after this. We'll make sure to put those links in the bio as well. Hannah, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate it. Feel free to come back on once we have an outcome from this international law complaint, and also to discuss anything else like those pesky gas taxes. But that's a show for another day.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, Hannah.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye. You've been listening to Done By Law on 3CR 855 AM, streamed at 3cr.org.au and available on various podcast platforms. Done By Law will be back again next Tuesday at 6 PM. Stay tuned now for the voices of West Papua.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.